Coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK,
The Lutheran Inquisitor, examining pressing issues and their ramifications for the church today. Reading Romans as Lament is the topic of today's show with your host, Pastor John Ehlers.
Hello and welcome to the Lutheran Inquisitor. I'm your host, John Ehlers. I'm pastor of Christ Lutheran Church in Orpington, Kent. I also serve the Reina Mission in the Medway Towns and also vacancy pastor of St. Columba Lutheran Church in East Kilbride, Scotland. I'd like to invite you along to join us for a service at any of these congregations. But if you don't live anywhere near them, why not go to our website, lutheran.co.uk, click on the directory button, and find the congregation nearest to you. I know you'll receive a very warm welcome. We'd like to thank you for your prayerful and your financial support of Lutheran Radio UK. Without your prayers and without your gifts, we wouldn't be able to continue this worldwide outreach to bring the gospel of Jesus Christ to all nations. Again, we thank you and deeply appreciate your support. Today, we're very excited to have with us Dr. Channing Crisler. He is professor of New Testament and Greek at the Champ Divinity School, Anderson University in South Carolina. He is the author of Reading Romans as Lament, and we are going to discuss that topic. Dr. Crisler, welcome to Lutheran Radio.
Thank you very much for having me. It's great to be with you.
As I mentioned, your book, I read this a little while ago and I thought it was a wonderful book. It is a book dealing with lament. Can you tell us what lament is?
Sure. I think when defining lament, there's probably sort of two aspects to keep in mind. One of them is sort of from a formal biblical studies perspective, and then the other is sort of a broader kind of theological definition. So in terms of what you find in the biblical text, both in the Old Testament and even in the New Testament, lament is a form of prayer. And so most of the time, you know, even the sort of lay Bible reader will probably pick up on these kinds of prayers and the Psalms especially. So something like Psalm 13, where the psalmist cries out, "How long, O Lord, will you hide your face from me?" And so it's a prayer form that's really marked by this really passionate sort of gritty cry of distress. But that's not all that it is. It's really much broader than that. And even in the prayer form itself, it's not just that one particular cry or complaint, but it's really sort of has a whole pattern to it. And so in part of the book, I talk about the fact that there's a pattern to these prayers of lament, and they really begin with a prior promise from God. And so without that prior promise, the psalmist really has nothing to cry out about. But what happens in the psalmist experience is that there's this tension or this conflict between the prior promise that God has made and then the suffering that the psalmist experiences. And when those two things collide, that prior promise and the suffering, it generates this cry of distress. And sometimes, again, that'll be a question like, how long? Or we think about Psalm 22, which Christ cries out in the Matthean and the Markan Passion narratives, you know, my God, why have you forsaken me? But there's other questions or sorts of protest or complaints against God. And again, all of that really results because of this conflict between what God promised and then what the lamenter actually suffers and experiences. And that suffering can come from any number of things, but I like to sort of group them together in two main sources of suffering. There's the external source of suffering, and then there's this internal source of suffering. And so the psalmist has political foes and enemies on the battlefield, political intrigue. But then also internally, there's problems within the nation of Israel. The psalmist sometimes has his own personal struggles with sin or those who betray him. And so he's sort of getting it from all directions, both inside and out. And so all of that collectively produces these cries of distress. And then in this same prayer form that you find in the Psalms, there's a point at which there's sort of a shift in the mood. And that simply means that somehow, some way, the psalmist feels some kind of response from God, some kind of deliverance from God. Now, it may just be that the psalmist recalls God's prior promise of deliverance. It could be that he receives a vision. It could be any number of sort of ways that deliverance comes. But in any case, there's somewhere in the course of that prayer form, there's a shift to some kind of experience of deliverance. And then at the very end of the pattern, it results in praise. And so if you go through and look at this prayer form and the Psalms especially, but really it's in all the genres of the Old Testament, you'll sort of see this kind of shift from all the way from, you know, a cry of distress to praise. That's sort of the formal, that's about the simplest version I could give of sort of the biblical form, of a prayer of lament. But from a broader theological perspective, both in the Old Testament and the New Testament, I really like to think of lament as a way in which we experience and we respond to God. Even in our own prayers, sometimes if we'll stop and think, we sort of shift all the way from what God's promised us, what we're experiencing, we cry out. We remember that he's promised to deliver us, and then we end with praise. But of course, that doesn't really settle things, because 5 minutes later we can go through the same exact sort of pattern or experience. And so I think from a broader theological perspective, it's very much a way in which we sort of experience the gospel. It's the way that we experience God's promises. It's not just a sort of steady diet of trust without complaint or without protest or without doubt. I mean, lament really gives you the license to pose some really difficult questions to God. And I don't see it in the biblical text as an indication of a lack of faith. I actually think it's one of the most it's one of the strongest indicators of a person's faith, because ultimately, they're holding God responsible for what he promised. And so the fact that they can still come to him and seek out the fulfillment of that promise, even though they're hurting, I think says a great deal about their faith. And so those are some of my, sort of broad strokes that I would paint in terms of a definition of what lament is, both from sort of a biblical perspective, but also a theological perspective as well.
I love how you paint in your book the picture, and you just mentioned this, of lament as oscillating between praise and protest, between cries and deliverance, between joy and despair. I think that's a wonderful picture, and a picture that our listeners can really relate to. I also like how you talk about how so much of this lament is spatial. Can you talk a little bit about that, the importance that space or confined or freedom plays in the cries of lament and deliverance?
Yeah, I mean, it's spatial both in sort of a metaphorical sense, but also in terms of experiential as well. Even the psalmist, for example, if you'll think through some of the psalms, he speaks of being in tight places, being surrounded, longing for God to put him in a broad open place. And so there, that whole idea of spatiality in Old Testament lament is sort of one of the common traits of this prayer form. But then also, yes, I mean, I think you may be referring to as well as being allowed to, having the space in our Christian experience to utter these questions to God, to ask for him to make good on his promises. It's something that I think that is very evident in the biblical text, and I think it's even more common than we realize in early Christianity and in the New Testament. And I think that that's where some of my book, I think, sort of challenges conventional thought and the status quo, because I think it's hard for us to wrap our heads around the idea that the early church, you know, who has witnessed the risen Christ, there's this assurance of a defeat of sin and death and Satan, that they would still participate in these sort of lament prayers that we see in the Old Testament. But in actuality, they actually have even more reason to lament, because lament is really increased by the hope that you have. And so the hope that Christ gave the early church, I think, actually propelled them to lament in even an even more intense way. And I think in Romans, Paul sort of echoes some of those prayers, but they're really ratcheted up, even in a way that sort of supersedes what you even see in some of the Psalms of Lament. And that's because I oftentimes tell my students that hope is a very dangerous thing. It's paradoxical in a sense that that the hope that we have in the crucified and risen Christ is both a great source of comfort, but it's also creates a great sense of longing. It creates a great sense of wanting to for Christ to return, to be at work in our midst, and so hope sort of can increase the volume of a lament, if you will, and this is something that I really initially in my interest in lament really came out of the work of Oswald Beyer, and out of a few different works, very small works that he had written. He wrote a small article, a small essay on lament, and he was the first person I'd really seen, and he wasn't even a New Testament scholar, he's a systematician, but he was really the first person that I saw that really appreciated these indicators of lament in Romans, and he made the point that that actually hope in Christ, again, sort of raises the volume of the way that we cry out to God, because our hope is so much much greater that it propels us to sort of be even more audacious in the way that we ask God for, and so it actually increases that lament. It kind of makes the space bigger for you to cry out to God, which I think is maybe counterintuitive to the way that we sort of think as Christians sometimes.
Well, you've talked about the lament in Romans. Let's go and look at some of the examples. You begin your study with Romans chapter 1, verses 16 and 17, a text that is near and dear to the heart of a Lutheran. But can you tell us how Romans 16 and 17 of chapter 1 deals with lament and the background of lament there?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, Romans 1, 16 and 17 it's pretty much agreed on. This is sort of the thesis statement of the whole letter. It's that, you know, it has that phrase, dikaiosune tou theou, you know, righteousness of God, that Luther says he pounded on day and night trying to understand what the apostle meant. And there's actually about three different sort of echoes of Old Testament lament that you see in these two verses. And what I mean by echo is that Paul is borrowing language, the language of lament, from the Old Testament, and he sort of incorporated in here into his thesis statement. And so what we want to do as Bible readers is to, first of all, hear those echoes and go back and locate where they come from. And when you do that, what you realize is that they do come from these lament passages. And then we then sort of set Romans 1, 16, and 17 alongside of these Old Testament lament passages. And it really sort of illuminates our reading of Paul's thesis statement there in Romans. So I'll mention really quickly just three sort of Old Testament lament echoes that you see in these two verses. One of them is actually comes from Paul's first statement, where he says, "I'm not ashamed of the gospel." And I think in English sometimes we hear that word ashamed and we think that Paul is merely speaking about the embarrassment over public speaking or the embarrassment of proclaiming the gospel in the first century. And I think there's certainly an element of that in what Paul is saying there and talking about not being ashamed. It sort of in some ways is parallel to what Jesus says in Mark's gospel about not being ashamed of him before men, etc. But there's also an element here in which this language is all over the place in the Psalms of Lament, and you can really see this in the Septuagint, in the Greek version of the Old Testament. You'll see these this same kind of language in which it's not just shame that the lamenter is afraid of, but disappointment with God's promise. So the psalmist will mention sometimes, you know, don't allow me to be ashamed of the trust that I've put in your promise. So you'll see this oftentimes in Psalm 119, which is that longest psalm in all the Psalter. And it's not just one great big lament, but it contains a lot of elements of lament in that long psalm. And one of them is this idea of not being ashamed, of course, before others, but also being disappointed that you trusted that God would deliver you and then he doesn't. And so I think what Paul is saying there when he says, I'm not ashamed of the gospel, is he, another way that we could translate it is to say, I'm not disappointed with the gospel, that God has not let me down, that what he promised, he's delivered through Jesus. And so that's one echo of lament there that I would mention. Another one actually that's sort of even more obvious and explicit is that, of course, in verse 17, Paul cites Habakkuk 2:4, but the righteous one will live by faith. And I think what we sometimes fail to realize is that Habakkuk, although a very small prophetic book, is actually just three chapters of lament. It has that whole pattern which I mentioned a few moments ago, in that if you read the opening lines of Habakkuk in Habakkuk 1, Habakkuk is crying out. He cries out, how long? He's confused as to what Yahweh is actually doing. And so when God tells Habakkuk that he's going to answer his cry by sending these Chaldeans to judge the nation, Habakkuk doesn't understand how this is going to end up being deliverance. This is just sounds like judgment for God's people. And so God responds to Habakkuk's cry by using the line that Paul picks up on, but the righteous one will live by faith. And in the context of Habakkuk, what God is promising Habakkuk is that, look, judgment is coming, but through that judgment there's salvation. On the other side of that judgment there's salvation for the one who believes, for the one who, to sort of paraphrase Jesus, the one who has eyes to see and ears to hear, that in this judgment, on the other side of this judgment, there's actually salvation. And so, again, we have Paul using an Old Testament lament text. And by the way, Habakkuk 2:4 is sort of the quintessential response by God to Habakkuk's lament. And then Paul incorporates that into his thesis statement. And so I think when I looked at this, it was an indication to me of what was really going on with these Christians in Rome, and maybe even with Paul himself, that they were experiencing a great deal of turmoil and suffering, both externally and internally, and some of that is fleshed out in the letter. And it's as if Paul is saying from the very beginning that, look, I know that what you're experiencing may in fact look like judgment, but in that and on the other side of that is in fact salvation. And in fact, that's what the gospel looks like, that it's the judgment of Jesus on our behalf, and yet hidden in that is in fact deliverance for the one who believes. And of course, this comes to, you know, it comes to sort of a climactic point in Romans 3:21 and 26. Through 26, but Paul's already indicating from the outset here of how he's understanding the gospel of God and the righteousness of God that's revealed in the gospel. He's indicating that the experience is one of suffering, it's one of uncertainty, and yet God answers those cries like he answered Habakkuk's cry by saying, look, you need to believe in what I am promising, even though that deliverance may be hidden in that promise itself. And then the third piece of lament that's actually also echoed in these two verses is when Paul speaks of the righteousness of God being revealed from faith to faith. And again, this echoes Psalm 98, which a lot of commentators of Romans will note. But I think sometimes what gets missed in the shuffle is that while Psalm 98 is not a full-blown psalm of lament, it does contain lament elements. And what I really tried to focus on in my work is not just reading Psalms in isolation, but reading them as a whole collection of poems or songs. That this is actually the way the Psalter, I think, intended for us to read the Psalms, is not to read them in isolation, but next to each other. And so, so for the psalmist to speak about God revealing his righteousness, revealing his salvation, is the way that he continuously answers the lamenter in the Psalms, that when the lamenter cries out to him, he reveals his righteousness, he reveals his salvation. And so when you put all those pieces together in Romans 1:16 and 17, when you put those three echoes of lament, it sort of sets the tone and kind of alerts the reader to understand that Paul's coming from a place of pain, but the gospel is the answer to that pain. That pain stems from all kinds of sources, whether it's an ongoing struggle with sin, internal conflict in the church that we see in Romans 14 and part of Romans 15, whether it comes from outside sources, sort of inimical forces like we see in Romans 8, that all those sources of suffering could lead the believer to conclude that God is somehow judging them, but Paul is saying from the outset, that let's see this for what it is, and that hidden in this suffering is the answer of the gospel, and that the gospel becomes the answer to all of this, all these forms of suffering that we cry out about, that this becomes God's answer again and again and again. And that's why in Romans, Paul again and again and again is articulating the gospel, because he's responding to this pain and to these cries that pain elicits. And that the gospel becomes the answer to those things. So,
incredibly interesting, Channing. You talk about this pain that's experienced by Paul or the church. It is interesting to me that if we move into one of the most controversial sections of Romans, Romans 7, there is this pain of the internal sin, or who's going to help me? Can you explain how this fits in with this type of lament and especially the internal type of lament?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think Romans 7, you know, you're right. It's controversial about, you know, who is the I in Romans 7. Is Paul referring to himself? Is he referring to the believer in general, to just people in general? What I really focused on in Romans 7 is that it actually is a perfect example of the whole pattern of lament that I was talking about, that Paul actually works through all the steps of that sequence, all the way from promise to praise. And of course, he has a very painful sort of shriek, if you will, in Romans 7:24, when he, you know, says, "Wretched man that I am, who will deliver me from this body of death?" And I think that what's going on in Romans 7, particularly from verses 7 to 25, and really it spills over into the beginning of chapter 8, is that I feel like Paul is, I really think that in my reading of that text, that Paul is describing the experience of anyone who has a problem with indwelling sin. And Paul uses the language of lament from the Old Testament to really paint sin as sort of this enemy. So while the psalmist would use the same language to describe a enemy on the battlefield or a political opponent, Paul takes that same characterization and applies it to sin. And so sin becomes sort of this force inside of him, or in any person, this indwelling sin, that takes a person captive, that won't allow them to do the good that they want to do, but instead they end up doing the evil that they don't want to do. And it's just this real struggle. And the more I read the Psalms of Lament, and the more I read Old Testament lament and juxtaposed it with the description of the I in Romans 7, it really struck me as if Paul is saying, this is a lamenter, and he is incomparable to anyone else that you'll find in the scriptures. Because whereas the psalmist will lament and he knows who he can cry out to for deliverance, and Paul's portrayal of the lamenter, he actually asked a question that the lamenter in the Old Testament never asked, and that's the question, who? He's so bewildered by sin and sin's use of the Mosaic law that he's actually come to a point where he doesn't feel like he can turn to God, because God would just condemn him for transgressing the law. And so it's such an intense and dark experience with sin that he literally is asking who is there left to turn to. And then, of course, in verse 25 and 7:25, he follows it up, you know, by saying, "Thanks be to God through Jesus Christ, our Lord." That it's ultimately to Christ that he can look to find this deliverance from the sin that dwells within him, that plagues him. Either, you know, if this is Paul before Damascus or after Damascus, obviously he's looking back retrospectively on the whole thing. But it comes to define the experience that anyone has with sin. What's different for the believer, though, is what comes in verses, the first four verses of chapter 8, and that the condemnation that they feel because of their sin that causes them to cry out finds its answer in the crucifixion of Jesus Christ, in God condemning sin, that enemy, in the flesh of Jesus. And so Romans 8, 1 through 4, in a real way, becomes that explanation of the deliverance that the speaker in Romans 7 was looking for. So if the speaker in Romans 7 is asking, who will deliver me from this body of death, as he or as she faces sin, as they face failures with the Mosaic law, the answer that Paul will always give then is that it's Christ, who's been crucified and risen, that he is the one who has and will deliver you from this body of death. So yes, I think Romans 7 is a great example of the Christian experience as an experience of lament and all of its sort of fullness.
Dr. Crisler, thank you so much for the beginning look at this use of lamentation in the book of Romans. If you will be happy to join us, we'd love to carry on our conversation again next week. Again, we thank you for your time, for the wonderful insights you give, and we look forward to carrying on our conversation.
That'd be great. I look forward to it as well.
Thank you for listening to The Lutheran Inquisitor with Pastor John Ehlers. If you have any questions or comments about the issues raised in this program, send an email to info@lutheranradio.co.uk. The podcast of this show is available from our website. Check our program online and stay tuned.